Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We've got lots of people in other committees doing bills. They'll be coming in and out. We're going to start with Department of Budget and Management, the Secretary's Office. So we look at this very carefully. And our analyst, Mr. Cash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jacob Cash. I'm a policy analyst for the Department of Legislative Services, and today I'll be presenting the fiscal 2025 operating budget for the Department of Budget and Management, Office of the Secretary. This unit includes the primary budgetary control units for the executive branch, including operating budget, capital budget, financial management, and collections on debts owed to the state. If you join me on the cover page, you can see the 2025 budget allowance is $40.4 million, which represents a 1.7% decline from fiscal 2024. The majority of that decline is due to a one-time waiver of rental costs in fiscal 2025 related to Central Collections Unit rental agreement. And beginning with the performance evaluation of CCU, Exhibit 1 on page 5 shows the CCU revenues versus expenses over the past decade. While there was a slight decline in collections and expenses, net profit was generated in fiscal 2023, as shown in Exhibit 2 on page 6. CCU was able to ensure that profit by collecting a higher percentage of debts owed to the state. And there's been an increase in EasyPass referrals to debt collection that were allowed to resume in December of 2022. And DLS is asking the agency to comment on that resumption of collection activities for EasyPass and any backlog that it might have created. The second performance evaluation is for the state vehicle fleet, for the goal of ensuring at least 25% of new vehicles purchased by state agencies are zero emission vehicles, or ZEVs. And as shown in Exhibit 3 on page 8, the state did not meet this goal in fiscal 2023, only purchasing ZEVs, only purchasing 14 ZEVs and reaching 16% of total purchases for which an option was available. One major obstacle to expanding the purchase of ZEVs is the lack of diversity in customization options to help meet the specialized needs of agency vehicle fleets, as well as insufficient size options and lack of convenient charging infrastructure. Exhibit 4 on page 10 shows the current $40.4 million budget broken down by unit. CCU is the largest budgetary unit, and it's self-funded by the fees they assess on collections. Of the remaining units, the Office of Budget Analysis requires the most resources, followed by executive direction. And Exhibit 5 on page 11 breaks down the budget by item. More than half of the budget costs are personnel-related, and IT services make up the second largest budget item, particularly for the IT systems that support the statewide budget system and debt collection systems for CCU, as well as IT services provided by DOIT and external contractors. Exhibit 6 on page 12 breaks down the proposed budget change of $693,000 by item. The main source of that decline, like I said, is the $594,000 reduction in rent related to the CCU moving from State Center and having the first year of those costs being waived as a part of their new rental agreement. There's also a reduction of $702,000 moving funding for the new fleet management major IT project into turning it into a major IT project rather than funded in the operating budget. Other sources of budget decline were related to reduced maintenance costs for the statewide budget system, as well as lower costs for a new communications vendor and other IT services. And those totaled a substantial reduction. They were balanced out by and large by salary increases and fringe benefits, as well as the conversion of 6 full-time contractual positions into full-time regular positions, and these are funded by CCU. The first issue I'd like to talk about today is the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA funding, that the state has remaining. These expenditures and the remaining funds are listed in Exhibit 7 on page 16, by policy area. This is based on Appendix R from the Fiscal 2025 Budget Highlights published by DBM. And they showed that approximately $3.15 billion was expended from fiscal 2021 to 2022, to 2023. And there remains approximately $557.7 million left, or 18%. States are required by the grant conditions to encumber the funds by December 31st, 2024, and expend them by December 31st, 2026. And Exhibit A on page 19 summarizes the remaining funds by policy area. The funding is split between many areas, with the largest being broadband expansion, totaling $190 million, or 84% of the funds that remain for those projects, particularly for network infrastructure. Public health has the second largest pot of funding remaining, next to the broadband, due to the healthy schools / HVAC allotment, which has not been spent at all, and totals $80 million. And thirdly, the supplemental instruction / tutoring program for K-12 education also has a large balance of $63.6 million, or about 42% of that allotment. DBM has reported that at least two high-level regular employees and one contractual employee dedicate at least some of their time to reviewing and managing federal funds. As well, they have the statewide contract with Hagerty Consulting to provide coordination, technical assistance, subrecipient monitoring, as well as other federal funding oversight requirements, such as data collection and reporting. That vendor has at least one project manager, as well as a variable consultant time that's dedicated to ARPA. Overall, because of this allocated grant funding will expire if they're not encumbered by the end of the calendar year, DLS is asking DBM to brief the committees on their plans to reallocate unspent funds, and DLS recommends the adoption of budget bill language, restricting $200,000 pending a report that outlines the previous, current, and future oversight activities that the agency is using to ensure ARPA funds are utilized. The second issue I'd like to address is the need for MFR measures for the expanded audit and finance compliance unit. And this issue begins on page 20. The unit is now larger than the Division of Finance and Administration, which is responsible for their internal DBM payroll, purchasing, and budgeting. It has 10 regular positions, only one of which was vacant at the start of this calendar year, and they've showed good progress in filling out the unit. While DLS agrees that this unit is well needed, as demonstrated in Exhibit 9 on page 21 that shows trends in repeat audit findings, the unit has not yet reported any outputs or outcomes related to their activities. The budget for this unit totals $1.9 million in fiscal 2025, and it would help to quantitatively track how that money is being used to improve state government. Exhibit 10 on page 22 shows that there are significant issues related to program compliance, procurement, and disbursement compliance, as well as IT system controls. And so related to this issue, DLS is recommending that new MFR measures, goals, and objectives be developed for the next budget cycle. The third issue today is potential underfunding of entitlements and mandates in state agency budgets, which begins on page 22. Individual DLS analyses for Medicaid, foster care, and debt services projected shortfalls totaling $290 million, as shown in Exhibit 11 on page 23. While there was a surplus of $46 million in Behavioral Health Administration that DLS estimated and other general fund cost savings of $29 million, the state is still likely to see shortfalls if additional funding is not provided. DLS recommends authorizing the transfer from the Rainy Day Fund of $65 million in fiscal 24 and $100 million in fiscal 25 to cover Medicaid shortfalls, as well as $34 million in fiscal 25 to cover foster care shortfalls. If the maximum transfers are made, this action would reduce the balance in the Rainy Day Fund to $2.1 billion, or about 8.6% of general fund revenues. DLS is also asking DBM to comment on the projected shortfalls and describe the agency's proposed strategy for addressing the underfunding. Finally, the fourth issue today is the monitoring of competitive grants with a state match requirement. Language added to the fiscal 2024 budget bill required DBM to submit quarterly reports summarizing the status of all competitive grants that state agencies applied to from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act or the Inflation Reduction Act. There was a large amount of money available, and that the state requirement may have an impact on operating capital budgets. Agencies that were applying for these grants were also required to notify the budget committees at least 10 days before submitting an application. According to the DBM report, 34 applications were submitted in fiscal 2024, but only two of them notified the budget committees before submitting those applications. Those two applications are still pending, along with 14 other pending applications. The 34 applications in total are associated with state matches of a cumulative of $553.3 million. It's not necessarily clear when all of these were submitted, so DLS is asking to repeat the budget bill language for quarterly reports and notification to the budget committees, and ask that they include the date that the application was submitted. To further illustrate the issue related to budgeting potential state matches, Exhibit 12 on page 25 shows four scenarios, two of which are compliant and two are non-compliant. The non-compliant scenarios 3 and 4 were reported by DBM in the quarterly reports, and as per our analysis, they would not satisfy the matching requirement of the federal grants. The grant is limited to 80% of costs being, or the grant limits total funds for the project to be limited at 80% federal funds, 60% coming from the grant in question, 20% which can come from another federal source. That leaves 20% that must be a state match, and if they cannot come up with the other 20% of federal funds, that would be a 40% state match. As you can see in scenarios 3 and 4, not enough of the funding would come from the state if MDOT were to be granted that full amount, and if the reward was reduced, as indicated in the second quarterly report, the state match would still not be sufficient. Since these scenarios presented by DBM were non-compliant, we adjusted them in scenario 1 and 2 to be compliant. And in scenario 1, we assume that the federal grant is received, and in scenario 2, we assume that no other federal grant money is available. In scenario 2, that reduces the grant award, so that it's limited to that 60% requirement. In the first scenario, the project is fully funded, but in the second scenario, the project is only halfway funded. And so this really illustrates the large impact that can be seen from the proper budgeting of a state match. Related to this issue, DLS suggests that DBM should work with agencies in future grant application reports so that the relevant budgetary decision makers are aware of all potential state commitments. The recommended actions for this budget begin on page 27 and continue through page 41. They're summarized for your convenience on page 2 and 3. I'll point out that recommended actions 1, 2, 3, and 7 are all new, while recommended actions 4, 5, 6, and 8 through 15 are annual recommendations for managing the budget process. Finally, recommended action 16 is related to those competitive grant applications. There are 6 appendices at the end of the analysis that document the summaries of JCR reports submitted in the past year, audit findings for the central collection unit and statewide budget systems, as well as major IT development projects for a new capital budget system and vehicle fleet management system. But that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for our analyst? Senator McCray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cash, this may be more appropriate for the agency, but could you just dig into on page 23 where you talk about the budget shortfall for Medicaid, $115 million and $150 million. What caused that?
Mm-hmm. At least, and the agency probably can speak to this a little bit more. Part of my understanding is that there was some dual enrollment issues in Medicaid and Medicare that caused underfunding, as well as other changes in estimates.
Okay, I'll ask the agency too.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jacob, you talked about the reallocation of unspent funding, ARPA funding. Does that work different there than it does with the dollars that we have here in the state?
Could you repeat that?
The reallocation of unspent funding.
There's eligibility requirements for all of that funding for what it can't be spent on, but there is a good amount of flexibility for most of them. It's allocated, 100% of the funds are allocated now, and we're asking if they're going to change around where it's allocated for them to let us know. But they do have quite a bit of freedom with that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Cash, on page 18 in the public safety part about the ARPA money, there's a line about home detention for early release. Is that out of the judiciary budget? We're dealing with an issue on that right now. I'm trying to trace the money.
I think the agency might have that information for you a little bit better than me. It seems like it could be the judiciary, though.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much. Secretary. I feel like I haven't talked to you in so long.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Helene Grady, Secretary of Budget and Management. I'm here with Mark Nicole, our Deputy Secretary of Budget and Management, and many of the members of our leadership team are here as well to help answer questions, which may go beyond the DLS analysis. First, I want to say the administration appreciates the thorough analysis put forward by Mr. Cash, and we also appreciate his patience with us with responding to the many questions over the last week or two. First, before we dive in, I just want to share that 1 year into this role, want to say that I'm extremely grateful for and impressed by the entire team of staff serving the state at DBM. That ranges from the operating and capital budget teams to the Office of Personnel Services and Benefits, the Equal Employment Opportunity Unit, our Central Collections Unit, our Audit and Finance Compliance Unit, our Fleet Management Unit, and of course, the fantastic staff within the Office of the Secretary. Particularly given that we're in a budget hearing right now, I just want to emphasize the thanks and how grateful I am to the operating capital budget team for the excellent work that they did leading the administration through this budget process. This was my first 1 year through the full budget process, start to finish. It was incredibly inspiring and motivating to watch this team, both the operating capital teams, lead the administration through this process. Across all of DBM, I would say that the expertise, the commitment, the work ethic, and the sense of service is truly exceptional, and I hope the committee can be proud by the folks serving you at DBM. Next, we are happy to respond to DLS questions and recommendations. Many of our leadership team, as I said, are here as well if we need folks to help with particular questions. The first comment that DLS asked us to weigh in on has to do with EasyPass debt collection activities. And DLS shared that the Central Collection Unit asked us to comment on the resumption of EasyPass debt collection activities and any backlog of such cases. We are pleased to report that EasyPass placed approximately 2 million toll violation debts with CCU between July 2023 and November 14, 2023. Total value of those placements is just over $63 million. It's our understanding that this inventory represents a fraction of the delinquent toll violation debts eligible for placement with CCU. So while we are working through these placements, we're also working with MDTA to resume placements on additional delinquent inventory in the future. The next area that DLS asked us to comment on has to do with ARPA funding, and DLS recommended that the agency should brief the committee on any plans to reallocate unspent funds to other purposes. What I can share today, and much thanks to Mark Nicole for his effort along with a couple other folks on our team to manage these funds so well. DBM is happy to provide the assembly with an update on our ARPA spending. As of December 31st, 2023, The state has spent $3.24 billion, or just over 87% of the $3.72 billion award. State spending increased by almost $100 million since the end of fiscal year 2023. Progress in spending has been made across all state agencies, but particularly with significant increases in broadband and education programs. I would report that the state has obligated 94.9, just about 95% of its award as of December 31st, 2023. DBM will be meeting with every agency with unobligated funds over the next month. And I also want to note that any funding that is reallocated will be processed via budget amendment, which provides the General Assembly an opportunity to review the new spending plan. To your question a few minutes ago, if it's helpful now, since we're talking about it, that we believe the home monitoring funding that you are referencing is with the judiciary budget.
They've been talking about a shortfall. Mm-hmm. Is it, I presume that that's included in their calculation that they are going to be receiving this?
Yeah, so this is the funding, my understanding, Mark, should correct me if I get this wrong. The funding you see in our ARPA numbers in the DLS report is the initial $5 million in funds that the judiciary received for this initiative, I think, per the General Assembly and or the Hogan administration.
Okay.
So they are spending down that $5
million. Okay, and they're still believing that their $3 million, is it, I think?
I actually don't know the numbers myself. I know that they've been in touch with both the governor and the legislature. Yeah. Our reporting as of December did not indicate the shortfall. I think it's more based on their projections with invoicing since December's report.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next topic that DLS asked us to comment on is around the funding of entitlements and mandates. DBM agrees with the projected shortfall estimated by DLS for the Medicaid program in both fiscal year 2024 and fiscal year 2025. What we would say is that subject to revenue estimates in March, DBM is considering supplemental budget funding to help cover the shortfall. When it comes to the foster care shortfall, DBM respectfully disagrees with the projected shortfall for foster care, and we believe those costs are budgeted appropriately in the governor's allowance. Next, DLS DLS asked us to comment on a number of recommendations, and what I can say, the first recommendation, DBM concurs, which relates to ARPA oversight and reporting. The second recommendation, DLS recommends that DBM develop MFR goals, objectives, and measures for the Audit and Finance Compliance Unit. We concur with this recommendation as well. I would just note that we want to clarify that MFR measures that relate specifically to the Audit and Finance Compliance Unit at DBM would be focused on the functions of that unit and not the outcomes of repeat audit findings statewide. Our unit offers support and consultation, but does not have authority or direct responsibility for addressing the repeat audit findings in other state agencies. Recommendations 3 and 4, DBM concurs with both. Recommendation 5, DLS is recommending amending Section 2 to limit appropriations that can be placed into contingency reserve to items restricted by the General Assembly. DBM does not concur with this proposed limitation on the Secretary's authority to manage the budget and would ask the committees to accept the language in this section in the budget as introduced. From what I understand from my team, the budget committees, in addition, we would recommend that the budget committees notify the comptroller directly rather than routing notification through DBM regarding approval of the release of funds restricted by the General Assembly. Recommendation number 6, DLS recommends amending Section 17 to disallow transfers to other purposes and make it possible for the OLA to track the disposition of funds in restricted statewide sub-objects. Again, DBM does not concur with the recommendation to disallow transfers from restricted objects of expenditure to other purposes, as in very limited circumstances, this can be a useful budget management tool. The language permitting the Secretary of Budget and Management to approve the transfer of funds from various statewide allocations for other purposes had been included in annual budget bills for several years prior to fiscal year 2016. Given that, DBM respectfully requests the committees consider rejecting the analyst recommendation and allow the new administration to resume this authority. Recommendation number 7, DLS recommends authorizing the transfer of $65 million in fiscal 24 and $100 million in fiscal 25 from the Rainy Day Fund to the MDH and $34 million to the DHS to address underfunding that materializes. DBM concurs with the recommendation. Even though we are contemplating potential supplemental budget funding for the identified Medicaid shortfalls, we are concerned that there is significant risk that additional shortfalls across Medicaid, including MCHIP and MDH Developmental Disabilities Administration, could materialize in fiscal 24 and fiscal 25. For this reason, we support the recommendation to authorize some drawdown of the Rainy Day Fund in both years should the shortfalls materialize. Recommendations 8 through 16, DBM concurs. I think that's everything. So we're happy to answer any additional questions.
Did you want to follow up on that, Senator McCray? Your previous question?
Yes, sir. That's what I was wondering.
Madam Secretary, on, I believe it was page 23, it talks about the Medicaid shortfall in reference to the two fiscal years. Just wanted to understand, like, how is this caused and what safeguards have we put in place to make sure that it's not something ongoing that we'll keep running into?
That's a great question. And my understanding, based on discussions with our team as well as MDH and DLS, is that the shortfalls identified specifically by the DLS analysis relate primarily to two errors or oversight in the governor's allowance production of the budget for the Medicaid program. The two errors are pretty specific and unique in that I understand that we had a inappropriate figure in a worksheet for dual enrollment eligible Medicaid recipients, as the analyst noted, for fiscal year 23. I believe that the number was understated by potentially $200 million. And unfortunately, that number in a worksheet carried forward to fiscal 24 and fiscal 25. Neither MDH nor DBM caught that prior to governor's allowance, but DLS was able to catch that in their analysis. The second issue, which is a bit smaller in magnitude, relates to the annualization of the 8% provider rate increases that went into effect in January. As we annualize those into next fiscal year, we didn't appropriately annualize that amount across all the Medicaid activities.
Got it. Mr. Che, if I can go into a separate subject.
Sure.
EasyPass was a big issue that preceded you, so it's not something that happened on your watch, but like something that preceded you. As we move back into CCU and the debt collection, did we make sure that we have addressed the issues where people were getting boxes of invoices after a period of time and we had to stop that debt collection because of the large scale of folks that this was happening to?
Okay. Mark, do you want to respond or should we ask Jesse? I'm going to have Jesse, our deputy director at the Central Collection Unit, respond to that.
Hello. Thank you for the question. CCU, when we bill customers, we'll actually roll up the debts into one notice and send it out. They will receive individual notices, I believe, from EasyPass. Keep in mind, we get the debts after they send them the initial notice, and then they go through a citation process, and then they receive more delinquency notices. So they're well over 90 days delinquent by the time CCU gets them. Typically, when we get them in files of, say, 10,000 transactions at one time, you know, numerous customers. We'll roll them up at the customer level, and then we'll send a notice out to somebody to let them know that the debts have been placed with CCU for collection.
And I think I might have phrased the question wrong. So people were getting these invoices. They were saying that the invoices were incorrect, and that's why we weren't sending them to CCU. I was just wanted to make sure that issues that was going on with MBTA, now that we're sending it to debt collection, has been addressed. Like the volume isn't happening in the scope that it was impacted.
As far as we're aware, when the debts are assigned to CCU, they're considered to be final valid debts. Okay. I mean, if someone has a problem with a transaction that they later find because they get a notice from us, and this happens a lot, they'll finally get CCU's notice and they'll contact MDTA and say, oh, I was having an issue with this. They'll still correct it.
Okay.
Okay. So it's not like they don't have the opportunity to still correct it, but by the time they get to us, there's been a lot of work that's been done on easy passes. And I believe they're still continuing that work as they're sending the backlog of the debts to us.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a comment now. No more questions. Madam Secretary, just wanted to say congratulations on your 1 year anniversary. And I really, really appreciated how you lifted up your team as you celebrated that 1 year. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. A quick question just to follow up on that line of questioning. The Secretary mentioned in her remarks that there were $63 million of toll violations, and that was a fraction of the inventory. What is that total inventory?
We reached out to Easy Pass in the past week to try to get a updated figure. We were unable to get that figure in time for this. We believe it's probably between a quarter and a fifth of the overall backlog. And that's based upon a meeting that we had with them in May of last year. They've done a lot of cleanup since then. Okay.
I'm sorry. The $63 million is a quarter of the total amount that's outstanding.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you could follow up with us, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. How does this tie, this shortfall on page 23? How does that fall? How does that impact the money that we get from the federal government? Does that impact?
Do you want to address that?
Sure. Thank you for your question, Senator. So this shortfall shouldn't affect our receipt of federal funds. When we go out and sort of pay those bills, we will submit the invoices to the Center for Medicare, Medicaid studies and receive the federal reimbursement. So it shouldn't have an effect on our ability to draw down our federal funds.
The we had visitors last night to come to our offices, and they talked at great length about what is happening with the cuts in Medicaid. And I'm just kind of, I'm a little worried about the conversation that we had, the impact that it's going to have on the little people here in the great state of Maryland. I know that we all need to, I know that it's tight. Our budget is tight, but I do worry about the Medicaid program that's in the great state of Maryland. And I'm just worried that it's going to hit the people that need this the most.
We can comment generally that I would say the governor supports your view that Medicaid and funding of healthcare for Marylanders is among top priorities for the administration. I would comment that I think the proposed fiscal 25 budget adequately, sufficiently funds Medicaid, including provider rate increases, et cetera. And so we're eager to talk with folks who believe otherwise and happy to help clear that up.
Yeah, this report clearly indicates that what has been proposed needs to be changed. It says that it needs to be increased. The funding for Medicaid needs to be increased.
Yeah, with regard to
this is a terrible hit here.
With regard to the shortfalls that DLS has highlighted in this analysis, we do agree, and we are working toward, potentially supplemental funding and or use of rainy day funds as indicated in the analysis and the response mm-hmm. to cover the shortfall.
Yeah, I see that. Okay.
And thank just you. To clarify too, the shortfalls aren't the result of reductions. They're the fault of inadvertent
weaknesses in the analysis.
Right. So we're going to fully fund those services, as required.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To piggyback on what you just said, Mark, so that inadvertent analysis has cost us roughly $200+ million. What is in place to ensure that we don't have any more inadvertent analysis, particularly in at any time, not just a tough time for the budget? So what have you all put in place? What internal controls do you have in place going forward?
Right.
That's a great question as well. I would say, you know, my first year through this budget process, participating in and observing the budget process specific to Medicaid has been incredibly enlightening. It's an incredibly complicated process with significant analysis by the Department of Health together with the folks at DBM and together with the folks at DLS. This year in particular, this past year, I was really encouraged to see the DBM analysts, the MDH analysts, and the DLS analysts establish a process somewhat like a consensus budgeting process through the year, where all three teams together were meeting to review assumptions, to review metrics on enrollments, particularly this year with redeterminations and many other things underway that caused this budget to probably have a bit more uncertainty than in you know, normal years. That process, I think, served us really well. I think we were as disappointed as anyone to learn of these two oversights, despite all of the sort of collaborative work that had been done on the budget. We will continue that process going forward. We welcome DLS's help on this. They are as expert as our folks and MDH when it comes to Medicaid, for sure. And we'll be looking for opportunities to tighten up, whether it's through better automation of worksheets, et cetera, going forward.
Mr. Chair, if I might. So I appreciate your response. I know that, you know, I'm not sure what's in place, and that collaborative effort is terrific. It's great. It works. And if not already in place, there should probably be, from an internal control standpoint, some sort of a, you know, periodic assessment on where we are through the process. You know, we are halfway through a budget. We're halfway through a session, and to find out something like this. So maybe, you know, keep the committee informed, but, maybe, as you all are looking at ensuring that we don't go through this again, that, some sort of, periodic assessments, because DLS is not always going to be available to do those, you know. I mean, it's fortunate for us that analysis came about. So we look forward to working with you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I wanted to talk about the ARPA money that's left. I've been working with folks on two aspects of it. One is our old friend, the $75 million that went to the workforce boards. And the other is the ESSER money that MSD got, and they put out $12 million to the Maryland Apprenticeship Connector that they told the connector had to be spent by, I think, October of this year. The workforce boards and the Department of Labor thought that the ARPA money for workforce went to the workforce boards had to be committed by the end of this year. Well, it turns out when people went back and looked at the regs or the guidance or whatever it is, the ARPA money that went to the workforce boards doesn't need to be spent until the end of 26. And it turns out that the ESSER money that went to MSDE is supposed to be spent by, the end of this year, but they can apply for an exemption to go through another 14 months. I'm sure you're all very aware of that. I'm not asking a question so much. What I'm asking a question is, have you analyzed that kind of across all the ARPA money as to what the real deadlines are as opposed to what the assumed deadlines are? Because it's very confusing.
I'm going to ask Mark to answer that. He is our in-house ARPA expert.
Great.
Thank you for the question, Senator. So I would say on the American Rescue Plan dollars through the state and local fiscal relief fund, which is the $3.72 billion award we received.
Yep.
We do have a December 31st, 2024 obligation deadline, right? As your analyst pointed out, we are very cognizant of that. We're working with the agencies to make sure that they have all those dollars obligated. We have until December 31st, 2026 to make sure all those dollars are spent. And as you know, there are a variety of other federal ARPA awards that we received as a state, including the ESSER awards and the governor's emergency education relief funds that have a variety of sort of different dates. If there are questions around particular ones, you know, we're happy to work with those agencies. We at DBM have had those. Our main focus has been on the state and local fiscal relief side, and other agencies are managing their own specific grants, but we're happy to kind of work with you and work with them as issues arise to clarify dates and deadlines. We know that's very important, and we are working with the agencies to make sure that the state gets everything obligated by the deadline and all our funds are spent.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful to know kind of the big picture there. And this is just free advice. Looking at the ESSER money in this one project with the Apprenticeship Connector and the ARPA money with the workforce boards, I know from talking to whether you call them grantees or whatever you call the people who got the money, meaning the workforce boards or this a grantee with MSD, until they found out that the money didn't have to be spent till after the end of this year, they were racing like crazy to spend money. And I think that's really not good government. And so I would just encourage you kind of across all these folks to try to help be as clear as possible that yes, we needed to get out the eviction assistance money during COVID. Yes, we need to get out the food aid during COVID. Now the money that is left, I really feel is important to be spent in a thoughtful way, and spending it a little later and not rushing it out the door, I think is an approach that would make sense for the taxpayer. That's the thought.
I would say we do agree with you, Senator. And right now our main focus is on making sure that all the agencies get the funding obligated.
I understand.
Because that's deadline number one.
I understand. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I just real quickly would just say that, Madam Secretary, I'm going to agree with the sentiment that, Senator McCray expressed earlier for you and your team, and we're very grateful to have you there. Very much appreciate working with you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Personnel. We have a witness. That's right. Oh yeah, right. I got it. Right sheet now. Robert, Gord. Was wondering about this. Nobody from the Maryland State Funeral Directors Association? Nope.
Oh, you
didn't hear. Okay, very good. Let's move on then. Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jason Kramer, and I'll be presenting the analysis for the Department of Budget and Management's Office of Personnel Services and Benefits. I'll discuss the ongoing issue of vacant positions in state government, statewide salary actions, and the state's health insurance plan, including the planned transition of retiree prescription drug coverage to Medicare Part D. Starting here on page one, the allowance is $542.2 million in fiscal 2025. Most of the funds in fiscal 25, as well as the funds that you see here in fiscal 2024, will be transferred out of the agency's, out of this budget to support state agency salary increases. The fiscal 2024 amount reflects a $30 million planned reversion due to expected vacancy savings. I'll next jump ahead to page five and the one managing for results item I'll discuss. Exhibit 1 shows state prescription plan spending by drug category. Diabetes is a big driver of both healthcare and prescription drug costs for the state health plan. Anti-diabetic drugs have been the largest share of prescription costs for some time. Since fiscal 2020, those costs have grown from $14.5 million per quarter to $29.3 million per quarter. In addition, the number of users of these types of drugs in that same time period has increased by about 31%. DLS is asking DBM to comment on the rising cost of these medications in the state health plan. Jumping ahead to page 8, Exhibit 3 shows the spending by purpose in the statewide program within the DBM budget. These are primarily funds for statewide salary increases. Funding is provided for a 3% general salary increase and regular increments for state employees. Funding is also provided for an additional increment for state employees who have been with the state since June 30th, 2019. Funding is also provided for the annual salary review, as well as a cost of living adjustment for SLEOLA members and a bonus for SLEOLA members. An increment for SLEOLA members, as well as bonuses for public safety, recruitment, and retention purposes. The statewide program also includes funding for fringe benefits. This includes $74.2 million for the Retirement Reinvestment Savings Contribution. In prior years, this funding was built into the contribution rates that are in each agency's personnel budgets. However, it's budgeted separately in this year's allowance. Statute mandates a $75 million supplemental contribution. It's a bit less than $75 million due to non-budgeted funds. DLS is recommending a BRFA action that would reduce that mandate to $50 million, which would allow for a DLS recommended reduction of $21.6 million in general funds. That action would also could also be used to repeal a provision on reducing the contribution by the amount of administrative fees paid by local school boards and community colleges. The statewide program also recognizes a couple of projected cost savings in the state budget allowance. There are $50 million in projected savings due to the transition of retiree prescription drug coverage to Medicare Part D. That's a half year's worth of savings as the change goes into effect on January 1st of 2025. DBM is also cutting the unemployment insurance rate in half and recognizing $6 million in savings here. Moving ahead to page 12, Exhibit 5. This exhibit shows the proposed changes in the fiscal 2025 allowance. Most of these items are discussed elsewhere in the analysis, so I won't discuss them further. One item that is not funded in the state, in the budget, this year is the employer contribution to the family program. That's due to legislation to delay implementation of the program. And DLS is just asking DBM to comment on the state's plans to fund the benefit for state employees. In the personnel section on page 14, DBM is proposing adding 2.4 new positions to OPSB in the allowance, one of which is a director level position that's focused on professional development and training. DLS is proposing is recommending a $36,000 reduction to reflect a 25% turnover rate for this new position. To the first issue on page 15, this issue is regarding state agency vacancies. To get started, I'll discuss new positions in the allowance. The fiscal 2025 allowance includes 2,452 new positions across executive branch agencies, excluding higher education. Of these new positions, nearly 1,200 are contractual conversions, and most of those are in the Department of Health. An appendix in the governor's budget books reflects nearly 400 of these contractual conversions that are not included in individual agency pages or in data provided to DLS. And DLS is recommending changing slightly annual language that would add a requirement that data be consistent through all materials reported to DLS. Jumping ahead now to page 17, Exhibit 7, just to jump into the heart of the vacancy issue. Since peaking at nearly 6,500 executive branch vacancies in October of 2022, the number of vacant positions has fallen dramatically to just under 4,900 positions in January of 24, as shown in Exhibit 7. And this improvement is actually somewhat understated, as several hundred new positions were added to the number of authorized positions in July of 2023. This current period of reductions is the first sustained reduction of vacancies that's not due to abolishing vacant positions since at least 2008. However, while improvements are clearly being made, the vacancy rate remains at 10%, which is historically high and much higher than the budgeted 7.8% turnover rate that's in the fiscal 2025 allowance. So DLS has recommended reducing funding by $40 million for salary increases in the budget for salary increases to reflect likely vacancy savings and a budgeted turnover rate of 8.6%. To page 18, exhibit 8, just a note on historic salary actions over the last few years. A primary strategy to improve recruitment and retention is salary increases. And exhibit 8 shows the last 6 or 7 years of state employee salary increases. They've increased by almost 33% since fiscal 2019. Page 19, exhibit 9, as mentioned earlier, there's $24.6 million provided for annual salary reviews. That's a little bit less than in fiscal 2024, but is higher than in all prior fiscal years. As you remember, the budget, as you may remember, the budget committees last year recommended that DBM commission a salary study to evaluate state compensation levels. PRM Consulting, did the study and compared state salaries to local jurisdictions, as well as the federal government, MedStar Hospital System, and the University of Maryland, which has independent personnel authority. The study found a well-designed but complex salary structure with 32 different salary scales. Overall, the report found that salary scale midpoints were about 4.6% below peers, but the standard scale, which most employees are on, is about 8.8% below peers. Moving on to page 20, the report made several recommendations regarding employee compensation. These included increasing the standard salary scale salaries by 8.5% and correctional officer scale salaries by 6%. As I mentioned earlier, the budget includes funding for an additional increment or step increase for state employees for longer serving employees that totals $45.9 million. In order to align with the salary study's recommendation, DLS is recommending adding language to the budget that would restrict that funding to instead be used to provide salary increases for employees on those salary scales. The consultants also recommended reducing the usage of annual salary reviews and instead focus priorities on regular moves through the salary scale, including providing additional steps in step increases in hard-to-fill classifications. With this in mind, as well as the state's structural budget issues, DLS is recommending deleting the funding for the annual salary review. On page 21, there was another task force or another JCR report that requested the creation of the Task Force on the Modernization of the State Personnel Management System. That group focused on the state's hiring process, which is primarily prescribed in state statute. The task force's report noted that the hiring process can take 90 days from job posting to first day of employment. Even in an ideal scenario, that time can last 63 days. That long period of time can often lead to the loss of candidates to other employers. The task force's recommendations included encouraging continuous rating of job applicants before job postings close, and creating dedicated staff to take ownership of the hiring process. DLS is asking DBM to comment on efforts to adopt task force recommendations. A couple other personnel policy issues to note. Funds are provided in the dedicated purpose account to allow for the development of apprenticeships in state government. DBM has worked with the Maryland Department of Labor to identify candidates for positions that could have apprenticeship paths. That DPA funding would pay apprenticeship costs rather than the funding for those positions coming out of agency budgets. On page 22, DBM is negotiating a new telework policy for state agencies, which are currently left up to agency discretion somewhat. And DLS is just asking DBM to comment on the status of this policy. On page 23, exhibit 10, the second issue I'll discuss is the state's health insurance plan. Premiums for most members increased by about 5% for the third straight year. Medical costs grew by that same amount in fiscal 2023 and are also projected to increase by 5% in fiscal 24 and 25. Prescription costs grew by 3.5% in fiscal 2023, but are expected to decline by 17% in fiscal 2025 due to the Part D transition going into effect in January of 2025. DLS is recommending annual committee narrative requesting data on the health plan spending. And then the final issue I'll discuss is the transition of Medicare-eligible retirees to Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage. If you remember a while ago, Chapter 397 of 2011 originally terminated coverage effective in fiscal 2020. That transition was delayed by legal action. Chapter 767 of 2019 established reimbursement programs for the coverage of out-of-pocket costs for retirees that were enrolled in Part D coverage that exceeded the state caps. That lawsuit that delayed implementation was dismissed in September 2023. Moving on to page 25, no changes to state retiree prescription coverage take effect until January 1st of 2025, as I mentioned. Before then, Medicare eligible retirees will need to select and enroll in a Part D plan. While every individual circumstance is different, federal changes to the Part D out-of-pocket maximums in the Inflation Reduction Act that go into effect at the same time make the state plan and Part D plan comparable, as shown in Exhibit 11. The largest difference is likely in out-of-pocket costs. However, retirees who retired before the end of 2019 would be reimbursed for out-of-pocket costs that are above the amount in the state plan. Communications about the transition were sent to Medicare-eligible retirees in mid-January. On page 26, that information stated that counseling would be provided to Medicare-eligible retirees to help with enrollment and the plan selection process. DBM is in the process of procuring a firm that will provide licensed Part D counselors. DBM is also working to determine the procedure for the reimbursement of eligible retirees, but it would likely be in the form of a health reimbursement account, which would be tax-free funds used to pay for out-of-pocket prescription costs. As noted earlier, there are significant cost savings associated with this change. DBM estimates $50 million in savings in fiscal 2025, which is half of the fiscal year. That is net of the additional costs for counseling and HRA administration. The change also results in a significant decrease in the state's other post-employment benefits or OPEB liabilities. The OPEB liability to the state at the close of fiscal 2023 was $11.1 billion. The state's actuary estimates that restoring full prescription coverage to retirees would increase the liability by $8.9 billion. DLS is asking DBM to comment on communication plans around the Part D transition, as procurement of a counseling firm and HRA administrator, and the amount of funds to be provided to Medicare-eligible retirees in the HRAs. Just to summarize, recommendations that begin on page 27. The first item increases the turnover rate for a new position. Items 2 and 3 are annual committee narrative. Item 4 restricts funds for the additional seniority increment to instead be used for a salary increase for standard and CO scales. Item 5 reduces the supplemental pension contribution. Item 6 reduces funding to reflect anticipated vacancies. Item 7 deletes funding for the annual salary review. Items 8 through 10 and item 12 are all annual reporting language, and item 11 is annual reporting language that has a new provision in it. And then finally, on page, a few pages later, the BRFA recommendation that I mentioned earlier regarding reducing the mandate for supplemental retirement contributions, as well as repealing the requirement regarding administrative fees. That can be found on page 33. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for our analyst? Great job. Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Helene Grady, Secretary of Budget and Management, joined by Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary, and also Christina Kaminsky, our Director of Employee Benefits Division, who I've asked to come up just to help with any questions or discussion on the Medicare Part D topics in particular. The administration appreciates the thorough analysis put forward by Mr. Kramer and also, again, his patience with us on responding to many questions over the last couple of weeks. Over the last year, the department, in collaboration with the governor's office and our colleagues across state agencies, has focused intensely on efforts to support the Moore Miller administration's goal of rebuilding state government. This work has been led by our Office of Personnel Services and Benefits with their agency HR colleagues, and reflects an incredible amount of work and accomplishment across a number of areas, including recruitment and staffing. We appreciate the recognition in the DLS analysis of the significant progress with hiring and reducing vacant positions over the past year, even while increasing the number of PINs. During 2023, the state added more than 1,300 net new employees in the executive branch after losing a net approximately 2,600 in the 2 years prior, 2021, 2022. The governor's proposed budget includes more than 1,200 new positions and 900 contractual conversions in the executive branch. We negotiated new MOUs for the majority of our represented workforce that reflect just over 5% in COLA and step wage increases for everyone, and another more than 2% step increase by January 2025 for employees with more than 4.5 years of continuous state service. We are also proud of the work that's been done over the past year, and much of it summarized by Mr. Kramer with regard to the task force on the modernization of the state personnel management system, the salary study that Mr. Kramer described, and also, very importantly, too, our first statewide culture survey. In collaboration with the governor's office, DBM launched the first ever statewide culture survey, as far as we know. The survey, which launched on January 22nd, 2024, ended on February 2nd, 2024, is intended to be a tool the state uses for generating direct feedback from state employees that will help agency leadership better address challenges across our various workplace cultures and continue to improve on existing strengths. We expect to share the results of the survey and launch the development of action plans in collaboration with agency leadership in the next several weeks. At this point, we're happy to respond to DLS's questions and recommendations. The first area that DLS asked us to comment on has to do with anti-diabetic prescription drug costs, and DLS asked us to comment on the increase in usage of these medications and efforts to limit their impact on costs to the state prescription drug plan. We've been closely monitoring the increase in utilization and cost of anti-diabetic drugs, which is largely driven by the emerging role of GLP-1 agonists. These drugs are increasingly used for weight loss and pre-diabetes management, which is not currently an approved use. In response to the off-label use, the state recently identified approximately 2,000 members who did not meet the criteria for use. These members received notice in November 2023 that their continued use of these drugs would require prior authorization for plan year 2024. This decision is expected to result in annual savings of as much as $10 million to the prescription drug plan. On the task force to modernize the state personnel management system, DLS asked us to comment on efforts to adopt the recommendations and whether we are recommending any legislation be adopted to enact reforms. While the task force felt the requirements in statute likely did contribute to hiring times, the task force also believed the time to hire could be improved within the existing framework. As a result, the task force made recommendations that did not require legislative changes. These include recommendations to establish best practices for hiring process timelines, increase communication with applicants throughout the process, expand use of open and continuous job postings, and update job titles to make job postings more attractive and understandable. The task force did acknowledge that further review of statutory requirements that govern the state's hiring process should be pursued in the future. DBM has begun work on a number of next steps and also looks forward to hiring the state's next Executive Director of the Office of Personnel Services and Benefits, our recruitment is underway currently, who will be charged with leading our efforts to implement many of the other recommendations. When it comes to the specific DLS recommendations in the analysis, DBM concurs with recommendation numbers 1, 2, and 3. Recommendation number 4, DLS recommends adding language to the budget restricting funding in the statewide program, $45.9 million, that is intended for an additional increment for longer tenured employees to instead be provided as an additional salary increase for employees on the standard and correctional officer pay scales. DBM opposes the restriction of these funds. The state negotiated this increase with the representatives of the bargaining units during the recently completed negotiations. The new MOUs containing this provision have been ratified, I can say now have been ratified, by the unions with whom the state negotiated this additional increment. and DBM feels strongly that this provision should not be modified. This adjustment for longer tenured employees is intended to help address pay equity and competitiveness issues that occurred as the result of several years without increments for these employees over the last decade. And this is, in, very importantly, an important element of our efforts to enhance retention. DBM concurs with recommendation 5. Recommendation 6, DLS recommends reducing funding for salary actions in the statewide program by $40 million to reflect likely vacancy savings and a budgeted turnover rate of 8.6%. DBM respectfully disagrees with this recommendation. We believe the recommendation would have an unintended consequence of slowing agencies' hiring efforts because of uncertainty about how much funding is available to them from the statewide salary account to support their salary expenses. We appreciate DLS's recognition in the analysis of the significant progress the administration has made in hiring and retention during the last year, reducing the vacancy rate from 13.1% to 10.4%, even while increasing PINs. The budget as submitted reflects an overall vacancy rate of 7.8%, which assumes we continue at about the same level of improvement in hiring over the next year that we've experienced over the past year. We have no reason to believe this momentum will not continue. We respectfully request that we retain this funding to continue the administration's and General Assembly's collective focus on rebuilding state government. Recommendation number 7, DLS recommends deleting funding for the annual salary review, or ASR. DBM also opposes this recommendation. While DBM supports the recommendation from the salary study to reduce the reliance going forward on ASRs, we would note that these increases were also negotiated with the representatives of the bargaining units during the recently completed negotiations, and DBM feels strongly that these agreed upon terms should not be modified. As part of the recent MOU negotiations, the administration has committed to launching a statewide labor management committee, including representatives from AFSCME, MPEC, and AFT Healthcare, as a next step to the salary study to explore modifications to the state's standard and correctional salary schedules, pay equity and salary compression, and make recommendations to the Secretary of DBM by August 2024. One goal is for these recommendations to support our movement away from reliance on ASRs going forward while we focus on improving the overall salary scales. DBM concurs with recommendations 8 through 12 and with the BRFA item.
Thank you. Senator Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Madam Secretary. Quick question for you. I am certainly in no way suggesting legislation versus CBAs. I understand that the purpose of them both. And I'm glad to hear that in by August you'll receive a report from a is it a work group task force about
labor salary? Management committee.
Okay, about that. And we're very much interested in seeing the results of those. And from an implementation standpoint, I am hoping that this means, as you all have been surveying employees within, state government and we see disparities, where you see disparities, I guess, CBAs, serve a role. I'm wondering what the role is of the, agency, or the department. When we find those large disparities, and if they aren't able to be negotiated, because, you know, let's face it, if you've been a part of a unit of work that has been perpetually behind, it is very hard to catch up. I've been on the employee side, of the union, and I've been the agency head, and I know how these, work. So if you never are able to catch up, the mere notion that we're going to put together a group to sit down and study this. What is the result that we're seeking? So if you find that there is a disparity more so than you have been able to make up or put a plan together to make up during negotiations, what's the next step? And I think the employees need to know that. And I think, again, don't get me wrong, I commend you all working together. I'd like to know what the next steps are. Because the state employees, I come from a county that's been very fortunate to be able to offer higher salaries and state employees. They get the training and then they go to many other counties and you continually lose them, particularly on the public safety side. the kids. How, and I'm not going to put you on the spot today, but think about this. What are you going to do when you find out information that we think we already know? Are you going to make the employees wait for the collective bargaining agreement? And I hope that's not the case. I hope that the agency, and whatever partners you identify, and please identify us as your partner, to write those, challenges that you're going to see when it folds out. So just want to say that. Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
I appreciate that comment. And I would say that we are eager to kick off our labor management committee on this topic. You know, I think that the, expectations going in are that it will be a multi-year process. I think we have tremendous amount of ground to make up with regard to the salary scales as well as internal equity issues. And in light of the budget challenges at the same time, I think we're going in good faith to figure out what's the right framework and structure for the state and how best to move us toward that. But I also just want to caution that from where I sit, I do anticipate it will be a multi-year solution process.
Well, I'd say I appreciate the caution, but I think it's really not necessary. If you're working together, I think once you're working together, you know, there is, but that's where the buy-in comes from the employees who actually are providing public service. Public service, none of us came here to, but we do want to be included. And allowing the employees to be a part of this process is a winning step. And as long as you all keep them in the loop, I think you'll see, however the growth cycle, as long as you're creating that growth cycle together, I think it's, being pointed in the right direction. So please include us and, you know, keep us in the loop, what you're doing. So thank you.
I appreciate that. I would also share, now that the contracts have been ratified, that part of what was negotiated includes some broadening of the current pay equity provision within the MOUs as well to help address some of these challenges.
Thank you. And thank you guys for the presentation today. I had two questions in regards to prescriptions and prescription drugs. The first one, it was in regards to, was at the beginning of the presentation, you talked about the diabetic drugs and the increase of those. And just wanted to get some clarity there. So going forward, will that will no longer be a permitted use for folks that are using it for the weight loss aspect that people have been doing? Is that what you were saying?
Thank you for the question.
Uh-huh.
The short answer is not necessarily. Okay. There are some other comorbidities that may allow the continuation of that drug, mm-hmm. but they are available for review through our prior authorization process.
Okay. So it sounds like a no. The second one, though, was in regards to the retirees and the retiree prescription drug plan that we've all been hearing about for many, many years, and it's coming to a head. Can you speak a little bit about, I know it's a process, maybe it's still being defined, but hopefully it's getting a little bit more defined as we're getting closer, the reimbursement process. I think a lot of the concerns, especially for the individuals who had retired, pre 2019,
pre-2020,
mm-hmm. That would then be reimbursed. But as we're all aware, some of these drugs have a very large out of pocket expense. And so, to pay for them up front is probably going to be cost prohibitive for a lot of these individuals. How will that process work as far as, because it's going to be challenging to put the money out and then wait for the reimbursement? Or is there could you just expand on that, what that process may look like?
Sure. Because of the number of changes that have occurred through the Medicare Part D program, specifically what will take place in 2025 under Medicare Part D, and then the requirements under SB 946, we are focusing more on a health reimbursement account, which would provide first dollar funds for a member to use when filling their prescriptions at the retail level.
So that means there'll already be funding in the account. So when they go to the retailer, basically they're going to have to put out their own money out up front and wait to be reimbursed by the state, or that money be
That's
in that
correct.
Account.
The reimbursement process as written is really not available in the market. So we've taken the legislation that was passed, mm-hmm. which included the option of using an HRA, mm-hmm. and we're incorporating that into the program for 2025.
Thanks, Christina. I might just add that this is all subject to, we have an RFP on the street now for a Part D administrator who would administer this HRA as well. So we do not yet have the vendor on board and the details all ironed out with the vendor, but this is what we envision.
Okay. But it does sound like there will be the individual is going to have to put the money out up front before they get see Mark shaking his head.
First, can you explain first dollar?
Sure. First dollar means prepaid. We'll be funding a certain portion so that we are in alignment with the legislation where we cap their out-of-pocket maximums accordingly.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We do want to clarify, we think this is a pretty significant change from what was originally potentially envisioned as reimbursement process in terms of the ease of administration for the retirees as well as the upfront out-of-pocket.
Thank you. First, let me associate myself with Senator McCray and the chair's remarks about the secretary and working with her this year. You're doing a great job. Your team is doing a great job. And Mr. Nicole was doing a great job even before you showed up and is still doing a great job.
For 22 years before.
So seriously, you guys are great. One specific thing that I've mentioned privately, but I want to mention publicly, is the task force on improving hiring practices, which we asked you to do last year, is the best single report of this kind by a state agency I've ever seen. It is detailed. It is honest. And it is creative. And I know you can't do all the things that need to be done immediately, but you are moving on things that you can do sooner rather than later. But it's a terrific roadmap. And for those members of the committee who have not taken a look at it, I would encourage you to, because clearly, the system can be dramatically improved over time. And it identifies the problems. Some of the solutions at some point may require legislation, but a lot of it can be done without legislation. So, any way we can continue to help that process, I'm speaking for myself, but I think the committee, we're on board with trying to be helpful in that regard.
I really appreciate that feedback and your support throughout the task force process. I do want to give kudos to Secretary Edwards, who chaired that task force for us and did a really, really tremendous job, along with the staff across DBM who supported her in that. It's a lot of work, but really great product out of it. And I agree with your comment about the roadmap. And as we're recruiting for the next executive director, I think it's perfect timing, and it will be a roadmap for them coming on board with regard to where we'd like to go over the next couple of years.
Terrific. And I was very pleased to see the active engagement by the union in it. I mean, that helps a lot. They know a lot about what goes on in hiring. And so that was important. So just kudos on that. Question on the we've also talked about this offline. The telework policy, what is the ETA?
We are working diligently to wrap up our negotiations with the unions on the administration's updated telework policy. A lot of work was done through the summer and into early fall, with regard to the policy itself. Part of the key goals, I don't want to go into too much detail because it is still under negotiation, but one of our key goals going into this, both I think for the administration and for the unions, was to establish some more consistent practice across state agencies, and that's important for both of us. And as part of that, that means that we are also being more diligent about identifying roles that are accepted from the telework policy, and that's sort of the stage we're in now. I see this as hopefully a very final stage of the negotiations, and we're anticipating hopefully a spring rollout of the updated policy and look forward to sharing it with you all as soon as it's finalized.
Thank you. I mean, I think we look forward to seeing it. I will say publicly what I've shared with you privately. And I was considering putting in legislation this session and didn't put it in, but you may be looking at it next year once we see the policy. I mean, I remain concerned that one size doesn't fit all. And I know the intent is to make exceptions, but I think strategically the way the world is going, not just state government, is we need to embrace the idea that some jobs can be done very well at a distance, some can't, and some people work very well at a distance, and some other people don't, and try to customize the policy to the task and to the individual, I think is an important principle that I hope is reflected at least to some extent in the policy, and then take a look at it once you've got it.
That's good.
Mr. Chairman, one more. Apprenticeship. So you put in the money, $2 million, $2.5 million, $3 million?
We proposed $2.5 million.
Explain just a little bit about what that money will be used for. It's great. I'm all for it, obviously, but how's it going to work?
Sure. So, And Laura Vicol on our team in our ledge role actually spent quite a bit of time with members of OPSB on this proposal prior to taking the ledge role. So I'd welcome her to join us if there are more questions. But DBM has been working with Department of Labor and state agencies to identify positions with high vacancies and develop apprenticeship paths. We have found that agencies are reluctant to give up regular pins to hire apprentices into. So the proposal is to fund $2.5 million to the dedicated purpose account to support the creation of a pilot program with 50 apprenticeship pins or thereabouts. I'm not sure if 50 exactly is the number we'll land on, spread across certain classifications that we've already worked with the agencies to develop apprenticeship plans on. These include MDH health policy analyst, public safety and corrections, parole and probation, SDAT real property assessors, and procurement officers across various agencies. The program would fund the salary and benefits costs for full-time apprenticeships, and we would work to draw down Department of Labor federal grant funding for mentor compensation and tuition reimbursement for the apprentices. Since this is envisioned as a pilot program, we propose to fund this in the DPA rather than adding ongoing structural expense at this point to the DBM budget or agency budgets. As the program design is finalized and negotiated with the respective unions, we would move to create the pins through the BPW. And if the pilot is successful, we would propose to build funding into future year budgets to sustain it at the desired level.
Great answer. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I wanted to jump back and just talk about retirees and prescription, plan, and the fact that I'm sure we're all getting these on a daily basis, but I wanted to read one that I just got. And it was, she used my first name, and she says, I'm one of the retired state employees who faces the loss of the state prescription plan. I worked for the state from 1960 to 2003. During this time, we were constantly reminded that our salaries might seem low, but the promise was made that the benefits, like the prescription plan, would last the rest of our lives, and so we stayed. I, quite frankly, feel betrayed by the state of Maryland. I worked long, hard hours and gave my job my best. My former coworkers, my family, all of us feel like we were completely duped by the state of Maryland. And I'll have to say that that is a constant daily thread that's coming into my office. And maybe it's because I worked for the state, but I hear that all the time, no matter where I go. And I just was interested because I've got people contacting me saying, hey, here's Part D and here's our medicines, and our medicines aren't on there and we can't afford it. And we've got to figure out, elderly couples, which one of us is going to get our medicine, right? And I look at the budget and I look about what we're offering, and I see that we're offering a catch-up provision for current state employees that actually have an insurance. They have prescriptions, and they're not facing what these people that worked for us and that we had a contract with for years are facing right now. And I just wanted to sort of hear how we move forward and how we assure these retirees that they really aren't being duped by the state of Maryland.
Sure. I'm happy to come in and then would welcome Christina to add anything if she'd like. I think what I would say is from the start, I think the administration and DBM takes very seriously the responsibility we have to ensure a smooth and successful transition through this calendar year for all of our retirees and their spouses and dependents. We take that seriously. We are, as we mentioned earlier, bringing on board administrator who will work to administer the HRA, as well as one-on-one counseling, both in-person and virtual group sessions. Our plan is through the summer and into the fall, leading up to open enrollment next fall. Our goal is to ensure that every retiree successfully enrolls in a Medicare Part D plan that's appropriate for them given the drugs they take and their experience. The administrator that we bring on board will actually enroll those retirees who seek their assistance, rather than retirees being out on their own, figuring out that landscape and figuring out how to get enrolled. So this will be a private exchange, enrolling our retirees into the Medicare Part D plans that make the most sense for them. Coupled with that, while I wasn't here over the years of debate in the legislature and the litigation that followed, I can certainly understand from where I sit the policy considerations that went into this difficult decision over those years for the state of Maryland. I think where we are today, the hard work that had been done by the legislature and prior administrations positions the state very well to leverage what the federal government has done. And Medicare Part D is a long way from where it was in 2011. That has given me great encouragement as I've gotten up to speed on our program and our transition and what we're planning to do with our retirees. In addition to the first dollar in HRA that we spoke about, the enhancements to Medicare Part D nationally and the counseling and the exchange that we're setting up will go a long way. We really do believe, we have confidence in ensuring that our retirees transition successfully to Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D nationally, I think close to 80 to 90%, I believe, of our seniors nationally are enrolled for their drug coverage through Medicare Part D. And I think given the enhancements that the federal government has done, you know, the timing is such that Maryland is poised to leverage that and not leave that federal support on the table, but be able to leverage that towards helping to continue to offer a very rich and sufficient benefit plan for both retirees and our active employees going forward. So those are my initial comments. I would welcome Christina to weigh in if she has additional thoughts.
Thank you very much. I would just have one follow-up to it, ask, when would that person be on board, and when could these retirees actually have someone to talk to that they can get it answered, right? That's something that is really a big issue, because, you know, in dealing with state government for years, they know sometimes the state government is not the quickest operator, and they're very worried about moving forward. And I just I feel compelled to be able to tell them, you know, hey, this is the date we're going to be able to move forward, and if you have that.
Sure. So thank you. While we don't have an exact date right now, we are in the process of procuring the vendor that will be providing this service. So it'll be a Medicare-approved vendor. They're licensed agents, and they'll be supporting our employees. Like I said, well, as the secretary mentioned, we're in the middle of our procurement, so I don't want to say a lot, but we are requiring that our retirees will be able to reach out prior to Plan D programs becoming available. So they are new every year. CMS will create the plans. Each state will have their own programs available. So those details won't be available till a bit later in the year, but we will begin meeting with our retirees out in every county, providing access to our agents in advance so they can, we also are preparing a full blown communication plan so that we are constantly in touch with them. I understand they're kind of in a place where they're feeling probably a little angst. We let them know it's coming. We don't have anything else to report yet, but we will be continuing our communication along the way.
So as long as we have a plan that we're moving forward and we're able to communicate to them what is coming, because right now I had a lady call, catch me last night, and she was like, there's, I think she said either 12 or 14 different plans that's out there, but none of her husband's medication is on either one. Right. And she's like, so what do I do? And I'm like, boy, having my phone number out there for all these years, really didn't suit this right, because I didn't know what to tell her. And, yeah. And that would really be important if we had that opportunity to turn her over to someone that can answer that.
A couple things to add. That's exactly what the administrator will do for us. And they are Medicare licensed and able to do that. I wanted to add that the Board of Public Works approved this as an expedited procurement to speed up our procurement process. There's only a small few number of these providers who can really do this for us nationally, and we intend to bring on the best. And we are anticipating, hopefully by this summer, having that firm up on board and communicating with retirees. And we'll be updating the legislature every step of the way as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator McCray. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just some questions, since I heard the line of questioning from that piece of it. So it was brought to my attention that there is some form of administrator, so I appreciate getting more information about that. Could you all make sure to provide the committee staff with the timeline in reference to the RFP that's being put out? Because I just wasn't clear on that component. I think at some point in time, understanding what are the duties of the administrator would be very, very helpful. And also, how do we measure performance? Obviously, we're dealing with an older population, so the whole email or things of that nature, we should take those types of things in consideration, because sometimes they don't have the advantages that someone else may have from that standpoint. So how are you all measuring that performance would be helpful as we think about what that contract look like. It was brought to my attention that there was a date carved out, I think, 2011 to 2020, in reference to offering additional help. Being also understanding what does that help look like, and just also understanding, like, if somebody worked for the state in 1990, why wouldn't they fall under that certain provision that this specific date was provided in the response that the, I guess, retirees received? And then my last question would deal with Part C and Medicare Advantage. A number of folks talked about the RX prescriptions and just how would that be able to complement, because a number of them may have this, but I'm being told that this will be disadvantageous to them versus advantageous from a supplemental standpoint.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. That's a lot of questions. Let me start with the last, which is with respect to the Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is its own, and I don't want to get in the weeds to you, but it's its own program. It's a Medicare program. It combines A, which is inpatient hospitalization, B, which is your outpatient services, and it may include D. That's up to the member. They have to maintain their B, but they would not participate in our program. They would maintain that. That would be up to the member to decide. Okay. Does that make sense?
Just a little, and you're hitting it on target. So I guess they were trying to figure out what did we put in place so that they could do both? So Medicare Advantage is, like, I guess supplemental is how I've always received it, where if you didn't have enough that you could then have the Medicare Advantage as the option to be supplemental to kind of compound on the services that you already had.
Okay. I see where you're going. So if you want the supplemental medical, then you'll have to be enrolled with the state and not enrolled in a Medicare Advantage. Okay.
For medical.
Because if you're going to have to be with us for the medical, you'll enroll in an individual Part D, and then you'll have the health reimbursement arrangement that we're talking about. Or the member may choose to go out on their own to a Medicare Advantage program. Okay. Let me go back to, I'm sorry. Can you remind me what your other questions were? The dates. Thank you. So the original, let me use SB 946, passed in 2019. The dates are hired prior to July 1, 2011, and then retired on or before January 1, 2020. Those are the people that have the assistance. Now, per the statute, because of the time to close the, settle the lawsuit, there is a group of people that were either hired as of July 1, 2011. I'm retired anytime. And then there's the ones that were hired prior to July 1, 2011, but retired after January 1, 2020. And so we will move them if they are Medicare eligible. They can stay on the plan as long as they're not Medicare eligible. But once they become Medicare eligible, then they would go out to an individual Medicare Part D plan. We will still provide the services to support them, but they would not be eligible for the reimbursement program under SB 946.
I think my question's offline, just for the sake of time constraints, but if you could get the committee the timeline in reference to the RFP, what are the duties and the performance metrics? And I'll reach out to your office just to get questions on 2 and 3.
And I can assure you, we do have performance guarantees in the RFP.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Secretary and staff, for your input this afternoon. But you know, we get a lot of correspondence from many people, texts, you name it, phone calls, all kinds of stuff. This one issue with prescriptive drugs, that is a big problem with our retirees here in the great state of Maryland. And they really do feel that they have been let down by the state. I'm just trying to figure out, Mr. Chair, if we need to go back. This one particular problem here is something that we need to take another look at, because it really is causing all kinds of problems for our retirees. They feel that they've been issued a slam dunk, and that is very troubling for me. The senator's letter is right on point. That letter really exemplifies what many of the people are saying to us when they send us the correspondence. I'm just trying to figure out how we can work it so that we can do something with that, the prescriptive drug, because it really is a problem.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how you all can do it, but somehow we need to go back and revisit that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I'll say is, we appreciate hearing the plans you have going forward. I am hoping, and I'm not seeing that with the correspondence we get on a daily basis, that you are conveying that to the retirees, because they have no idea that help is on the way. Mm-hmm. They're just sitting there saying, okay, let me grab my senator or my delegate. And we don't have information until today. This is a terrific plan that you're looking to do what you're going to do. That's great. That needs to be conveyed to your retirees. So if you could, you know, focus a robust outreach to them to say, hey, look, this is what our plan is. And trust me, by the letters we get, they will be able to grasp what you're saying to them. But they're in the dark. And the worst place to be is in the realm of the unknown. And we owe them more than that. All right. So thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have, 5 people signed up. 2 favorable. Denise Gilmore, Ginger Noble.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Gilmore. I'm the legislative director for AFSCME Council 3. We represent the majority of represented employees in state government. I'll be extremely quick. You should hear from the state employee next to me who traveled all the way from Hagerstown over me. But, you know, I want to echo the sentiment on just making sure that we, in these tough, you know, budgetary times, that we avoid cutting from state employees, cutting from active employees, cutting from retirees. I think, you know, that certainly includes the DLS. You know, we respectfully reject the DLS recommendations on, you know, cutting and reallocating the negotiated wages. We agree with the secretary on much of those positions. Look, we are working on rebuilding our government. We don't want to be any further handicapped with you know, some of the options that were presented in the analysis. So we would, you know, sincerely appreciate your support in pushing those back. Completely agree on, you know, where we are with the SPMS task force. I'll just end, you know, this most recent discussion on retiree health benefits. It's been, or, you know, prescription benefits. It's been really tough. I can sympathize. I also receive all the calls in my office from retirees, and rightfully so. I mean, these were decisions that we made over a decade ago. At this point, we would certainly, you know, as we move forward, you know, prefer to look at this, if we can in the interim. You know, let's get the relevant stakeholders, in place and really look how, look to see how we can, you know, shore up, our retirement, benefits for our, state employees, get the right people, at the table and see if we can even improve, some of these benefits. I mean, right now, a state retiree is retiring on average at about $1,500 a month. That is not enough to survive in retirement. And, you know, we would love to continue working with this committee, and, DBM and, the state retirement agency and really figuring out how we can, improve that. But I will hand it over now to Ginger.
Good afternoon. My name is Ginger Noble. I'm AFSCME president of Local 354, which covers Washington and Frederick County. I'm also one of the regional vice presidents for Western Maryland. So I have Frederick, Washington, and Allegheny counties. And I represent all the state employees in that capacity. I've worked for the state for almost 23 years, will be 23 years in May, and I'm a conservation planner. The majority of my goal in my capacity is we do something called WIP goals. So we have an EPA goal that has to be met by 2025. And my husband is also a state employee for over 23 years, will be 24 years in October. So a dual state employee household. I should be at a step 13. I'm at a 22. That's $14,000 a year. Take that times two. I think I did the math last year when I testified. The numbers really hasn't changed that much on how far I'm behind just in steps. That's as far as money. But really, I don't want to just talk about myself. I want to talk about some of my employees. I'm struggling to get by as it is in my household, but I've had so many members that have come to me that are facing homelessness. I've had members living out of their car. They've lost their apartments, their homes. They've lost their car. They're just struggling. They can't find food. I'm looking up food banks in order to help them survive. And that is not the point where we need to be. We should be thriving, not struggling and barely surviving. Now, I have members that if they, whenever they get injured on the job, because I do have forensic facilities, corrections in my region, people get injured. They're getting 2/3 of their pay and they can't then work the overtime that they were then depending on, plus their full pay they were depending on. And that also is whenever they're losing their places to live. They can't afford childcare. They're having to depend on our own social services programs that we provide as state employees in order to try to survive. They have to choose between work or do I take care of my children? That isn't where we should be as state employees. These challenges weren't created overnight, and it's not going to go away overnight. It's going to take a lot of collaboration and sustained effort in order to correct them. And I'm asking that as we move forward as state employees, the ones that keep the state running, that we continue to receive your support. We very much need your support, and that you don't balance the budgets on us, on our children, on our families. And we just need a fair process for negotiating yearly cost of living adjustments and steps, and to also pass binding arbitration this year in order to help everybody receive those. And thank you.
Senator Corman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, Ginger, thank you for being here. Good to see you as always. My question is actually for Denise, and I appreciate you bringing up the prescription stuff that we also started talking about here. I haven't heard a whole lot from AFSCME and what their position has been. So I guess two part. One, what's AFSCME's current position? and this mm-hmm. ongoing conversation, and two, what was ASPE's position in 2011 when that went through the BRFA?
So we oppose that and continue to oppose the transition to Part D. You know, in 2011 to this day, the largest rally that I've ever been a part of here in Annapolis was 10,000 union members, right? And lawyers all marching up, protesting many of those changes. Our retiree chapter, I think, you know, we're taking the lead from them. Obviously this is, they're affected by it, you know, more than, you know, we are currently. And I know our retiree chapter continues to, you know, oppose it. It seems like, and I'm not in your shoes, certainly. I know these are all tough choices, but, you know, it seems like letting folks choose makes some amount of sense. But, you know, again, I think, there are just a ton of, you know, really, tough choices that I know that are in front of you. And, you know, our request certainly is that we're not, you know, looking to balance any of this off the backs of folks who are certainly working currently or, you know, who want to work in the future. I mean, I think that we've got to figure out a way to pay for all of it, ideally. And if we can't do that, then we've got to mitigate the harm. But I don't think that, you know, in your district, I'm thinking of correctional officers that I've spoken to recently who have, you know, situations where they have so few staff that it really is leading to dangerous situations. I mean, we can't balance it at, you know, the cost of that. So we're happy to let our, you know, retiree chapter, we support them. We're going to let them lead the way on this, but we certainly think that maintaining the state benefit would be the fairest thing to do for folks who were promised it when they first got hired. Right.
Senator Salmi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm sorry your workers are in the position that they're in because they shouldn't be.
Thank you.
I know how it works with grades or scale pay. And I know those jumps from one place and one scale to another can make a major difference in life. I remember being a laborer and the position that I was in and I worked hard. And the time that I went through for 25 years working in the union. And that opportunity to fight to be a relief operator to get a pay that I got, that I finally got a place where I was happy because I could make it. I know how much of a difference that made in my life being a married man with three kids. So I know how important that is with you and with your workers. And I know you had an agreement and that's great, but I'm hoping that the workers there get what they need. So they just can't make it, but they can make it for their kids and make it for their families. Cause I know that will make the difference. And again, I'm sorry what you're going through, but I believe this committee wants best for families, whether you're in union or not, it's important. And so we're hoping that you can get to a place where you can say that both of you working, that you're okay, but your other workers will be all right. So I'm sorry, but I hope we can get there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you.
I have three other people signed up, and they've signed up as their position is info. Peter Richkis, James Roberts, John Didai. You can all come up. Hi. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Peter Richkis here. Viable options do exist to enhance the state's standing with the bond rating agencies and continue retirees' prescription drugs. Many, like GASPE itself, and the Daily Record Advisory Board agree the state owes retirees the benefits promised. As the pie chart shows, it's not fair to blame the oldest of our state retirees for the OPEB liability. Retiree prescriptions are less than 15% of the health insurance pie, even less is attributable to Medicare-eligible retirees. That sliver is not a threat to our AAA bond rating. Fact, rating agencies have never downgraded a state solely based on unfunded OPEB liability. The greater threat to Maryland's bond rating is addressed in the latest reports from the three rating agencies. Weaknesses in the state's pension trust funding. The OPEB trust fund is mentioned by the rating agencies, but it's the state's failure to fund the trust that has drawn attention. The recent $25 million contribution to it, while modest, will register positively with the rating agencies. Best practices and experts emphasize the advantages of pre-funding an OPEB trust, including enhancing credit ratings. 75% of retirees, including most of the 55,000 plus affected by this insurance change, live, spend more than $3.5 billion a year in their pension payments, and vote in your districts. State retirees ask the General Assembly, with this committee's leadership and the support of the governor, to address Maryland's financial stability concerns and honor the promises made to retirees hired before July 1st, 2011. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir.
Good afternoon. My name is James Roberts. The state is concerned that the retiree prescription program raises OPEB liability, which could harm the state's bond rating. But DBM's actuarial reports show that the Medicare-eligible prescription plan added only 1% to net OPEB liability per year for the last 4 years. The cost of the retiree prescription plan only represents 0.3% of the state total state expenditures. There's ways that this could have been addressed. Pre-funding would have saved $6 billion in OPEB liability per year and $110 million in costs over the last 5 years. And this is from DBM's own actuarial reports. The other issue is that Part D is not equivalent to the state retiree prescription plan. The formulary, that is the list of drugs for the state retiree prescription plans, is more extensive than the formulary for any Part D plan. Retirees must pay the full cost of drugs not covered by the formulary, and these drug costs are not included in the caps, and they're not included in the benefits that were provided by Senate Bill 946. A comparison of Part D and state plans using a prescriptions of an actual retiree that we've done shows that even the lowest expense costs would be, or over the lowest expense plan would cost over $3,000 more per year over the state prescription plan due to the fact that many of the drugs would not be covered. So there are many questions that need to be answered before we start talking about eliminating the retiree prescription plan. First of all, DBM provides an estimate, as they were talking about just a few minutes ago, of the increased OPEB liability if the prescription plan is discontinued. But they have not provided an estimate of how much we will save DBM provides an estimate if it is continued, but they haven't provided an estimate how much we would save if it's discontinued. How can we say that there will be an improvement in bond rating if we don't know how much we're saving in OPEB liability? And we've been trying to find that for months and we've not found it. Next, if we take away the plan, will reducing OPEB liability increases by only 1% per year really have an effect on the bond rating? Do those bond agencies see that? There are other ways to reduce the retiree prescription plan costs. One is pre-funding, as I mentioned before. Another is we could examine alternative premium models. I propose that you delay the termination of the state retiree plan until a study can be conducted that will answer the questions related to this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much. And that, I believe, concludes the hearing today on the DBM budget. And we're going to take 5 minutes. Thanks.